This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and today, once again, we'll be putting the V in variety as we explore a whole host of the arts, some of which may be new to you. The art of winemaking, layering pastel paints, and the Mighty Wind Symphony, to name but a few. But first, it's Eddie Garcia's interview of a scientist with a passion for music who happens to manage one of the hottest recording studios around.
In the musical world of Celestigram, the past and the future collide like a glittering big bang. Singer, songwriter, and mellotron player Amanda Lindsay is a recent graduate of the UNC Chapel Hill Archaeology and Biology programs, and these studies spill into her music in unique and unexpected ways. Her debut album, Wish Vehicles, is filled with songs about literal and metaphorical transformation, ritual, exploration of the earth and the heart, and pop songs that journey deep into the cosmos. It was recorded in collaboration with Mitch Easter at the Fidelatorium, the storied recording studio that Amanda also manages.
Well, I called the album Wish Vehicles because this was a term that had been used to describe these tiny clay figurines that were found at the site of Çatalhöyük in Turkey, which is a 9,000-year-old town. They appear to have been made really quickly and disposed of after they were used. And they're called wish vehicles because they had this magic power, we think, for the person who made them in the moment. And then they did their job. They were thrown away. And so this seemed like a really appropriate title for a collection of pop songs.
In 2015.
Yes. Because they're filled with intention in the moment of creation, and then they're gone. And maybe someday, if we're lucky, somebody will dig them up and discover them again. When I began studying archaeology and I realized that I wanted to seriously pursue a life as an archaeologist, I worried that I wouldn't have time to be a musician anymore. But the more I studied the past, the more I realized how important it is to document your own life now in the present. Because if people had not done that in the past, we would have nothing to work with. I do prehistoric archaeology, so we have no written texts. We want to know what people were thinking. We want to know how the human consciousness evolved on this planet. And it's because people took the time to make things, to paint on cave walls, to engrave strange ritual scenes onto their rings. Because of those people, we have information.
You're the songwriter, you're the singer in Celestigram. You also play the mellotron. Explain what a mellotron is to someone who might not be familiar with it.
Sure. A mellotron is a keyboard that was developed in England in the early 1960s, and it was actually sort of stolen from an American model called the Chamberlain. And we have one at the Fidelatorium. And what it is, you press a key, it's the orchestra at your fingertips. So it's not synthesizing sounds. It is actually replaying tape loops of pre-recorded sounds. So somebody actually played the flute. You press a note, you hear the flute that someone played. You hear the violins, you hear the choir. And so I got a mellotron for the purpose of making this record.
And, oh, really?
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, the mellotron was like the first sampler.
Yes. Hey, entropy, I'm sick of safety.
And what you're making is pop music, but it's, I mean, it's psychedelic pop music.
Well, I think it's always a combination between a bit of wildness and weirdness and then taming that into a format that people recognize and they want to play it over and over. And that is a mystery, like why you need to hear a song so bad. You know, sometimes a song will pop into your head and you just need to hear it immediately. And it's like the only thing that you need right in that moment. And you hear it and it's like your whole body is just filled with transformation or just a feeling. And no, you don't always need the pop format to have that, but that's just what I like. I like a catchy chorus. I always have. So I like trying to cram a lot of information into that. I like the idea of it just being short. What can you say in 3 minutes?
What does psychedelic music mean to you?
I think that's a really good question because it's a word that people use all the time now. And I wonder that myself. I wonder if I even want to use that word. Am I psychedelic? Are you psychedelic? What does psychedelic mean? Because it's not really about your echo pedals or your vocal effects. I think that psychedelia is a feeling that you want to have in your body with your senses. I think it's about transformation. You hear a sound and it changes you.
Celesta Graham's music video for the song Boss Taurus expands on the album's theme of transformation. Amulets, altars, ceremony, vivid colors, they're all in the mix, along with a live snake.
I made it with my friend Zoe Diemer. She's made a few local videos. She just graduated from art school. She loves snakes, and we met and talked about what we wanted to do, and I had explained what the song was about, how I wanted to really explore what it meant to symbolically tame wildness. What we were trying to do with the snake was bring to life a famous statue from Minoan Crete, who is commonly known as the Minoan snake goddess, who is found in the temple repositories at the Palace of Knossos and dates to about 1500 BC. And so we were trying to evoke what these snake rituals would have felt like, something that you're not going to see in a museum, right? You're going to see the statue behind glass. And we were trying to explore what that would have looked like and what that would have felt like with a real body. So the snake was crawling all over me. It was a very nice, sweet snake.
Had you had experience with snakes before?
I did. I had a snake, okay. A little corn snake when I was growing up. So I always liked them. But this snake was very special.
Did the snake have a name?
Ashley.
Ashley. Yeah. Ashley the snake.
We're preserving things now that people will find thousands of years from now. How do you feel that music recordings play into that?
Well, this is really the dawn of preserved sound. 99.9% of the archaeological record does not include the sounds that people were making. And as an archaeologist, that's frustrating. We can look at paintings and carvings and bones. We can't hear their sounds. People will be able to hear the sounds that we are making now. This is really the first time this has been able to happen, that we get to document our metaphor, our symbolism through sound. And sometimes we don't feel like that's meaningful in the moment. You know, maybe no one comes to your show, or it's hard to sustain yourself as a musician in our culture. Remembering that thousands of years from now, someone might excavate your record and put it on, and it could affect them. You know, I think about how much these cultures that I study in the past have affected me. Not just because I've learned things, they've affected me emotionally. They've presented me with new frameworks through which I see my life. The framework through which I see everything has changed. And I'm not saying your record is like totally going to blow someone's mind in the year, you know, 9,050, but it might. And you don't know that. The past is always speaking to the present, and the present is always speaking to the future. So while I'm primarily interested in the past, I think that I made my record for the future.
So do we have a responsibility then? There's so much musical output, right? Especially now more than ever. Is there, I don't know where not to say, but is there too much? I mean, how do we have more of a responsibility than we realize to be preserving something decent for the future?
Yes. I think we do have a responsibility. And maybe we shouldn't be too self-conscious about it. I think we should just live our lives. One thing that's always been a problem in archaeology is that we know very little about how regular people lived. Archaeology privileges the king's tomb or the royal palace, and these are the things with the fancy jewels and the gold masks, that the treasures, right? Mm-hmm. And the town where the normal people lived is just not as exciting. But that's really where it comes alive. That is where you see how life really was. That's where you can piece together the story. And so I suppose as an artist living in 2015, yeah, you may not be Beyoncé, but you're the person living in the town, and you're just as valid. Your narrative, the way you condense the information in your life into symbolism, may be meaningful someday. Or not. But you don't know. So you should just do it.
Well, Amanda, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Eddie. Thank you for having me.
Amanda Lindsay. The debut album by Celesta Graham is called Wish Vehicles, and it's available right now on CD and online. To see the video for Boss Taurus, visit WFDD.org and click on Try It Arts Weekend.
Technical producer Eddie Garcia. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take a short break from the arts before returning with a glass of wine. Pretty nice, huh? Not just any wine, though. International award-winning Pinot Gris, Chardonnays, and more from the Brushy Mountain Winery in Elkin. That's right, the art of winemaking next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend, where we bring the arts directly to you. I'm David Ford, and we'll have the Piedmont Winds and Pretty Pastels for you in just a bit. Before that, however, I think it's time to pay homage to the mighty grape. North Carolina's first commercial winery was established in Halifax County back in 1835. 5 years later, our state was leading the entire country in wine production. The industry was crushed by Prohibition in 1909, and it wasn't until the 1950s that things began turning around. By 2006, there were 13 wineries in Yadkin Valley alone. That's the year Brushy Mountain Winery opened in Elkin. Today, there are more than 40 Yadkin wineries. They're winning international awards and gaining the attention of winemakers around the globe. That's music to the ears of Brushy Mountain owner and App State graduate Jason Wiseman. Music that he brings to his sipping room every month. He's joined by singer-songwriter Julian Charles of Bandit's Roost. Their new CD is titled Stone Circles, and by golly, we're sampling from it even as we speak. Tell me a little bit about the art of winemaking, the art part. What's the art part for you, the artistic part of the process of creating a good wine?
That all starts in the vineyard. I mean, wine is made in the vineyard. And we work, being an urban winery, we're located downtown Elkin, right on Main Street. We work with growers throughout the Yadkin Valley, and we rely on them to produce great grapes for us. And it starts there. Once the grapes come into the winery, we taste them, and that's where the art of winemaking starts. We see the flavors that are in the grapes, and we just try to gently guide them where we want them to go.
That's where the interest is for me now. When you see the flavor elements in the grape, is that analyzed via computer these days, or is it all on you, or how does that flesh out?
A little bit of taste is very important, so that's subjective, really. But we do some chemistry in the lab, very simple chemistry, measuring sugars and acids, which kind of dictate the style of wine that we're going to make. At the end of the winemaking process, we'll send samples out to labs that can do more comprehensive analysis, but most of it's done in-house.
Has it happened where you feel like, oh, this grape has this sort of flavor profile, we'll say, and it's going to be this type of wine, and then you go into full-scale production? Is there a lot of variance there?
There is, and sometimes that's the best surprise. You know, it could be a challenging vintage. Say we get a lot of rain right at harvest, and things aren't looking very good, but once you get the grapes into the cellar and you've finished the fermentation and you start to evaluate the wines, a lot of time it surprises you. The flavors are there, even in ways that you didn't expect. So that's really been one of the greatest pleasures, is to see that development and it change in ways that you didn't expect, and generally for the better.
Since you purchased the winery, you've hosted a lot of live music out that way, every Friday and Saturday night, featuring local and regional artists. And first off, why is that important to you? Why bring music into a winery?
You know, it just seems to go together. People love to hear live music. Our tasting room is such an intimate environment. You get right up close to the artist, and we focus on local artists that do original music, so it gives people the opportunity to hear something new each time they come in. And we've had artists that you've had on your program. Larry G. Davis has played before, and other folks, and it came out of our love of music, and it all started when we realized how good that room sounds. We felt we had something special there.
From the musician's perspective, Julian, tell me about that, the venue. How many does it seat roughly, and what's it like playing there?
Brushy Mountain is one of those very special places to play. It's very personal. You're sharing the room with an audience who want to hear what you're playing. So seat 52 in there, for me and my music and for Bandit's Roost, it's home for us in terms of where we started. To play regularly down at Brushy Mountain is one of our favorite things to do.
That issue of playing music, the sort of music that you all play, in intimate surroundings, surrounded by people, what's the give and take like when you're up on stage, and can you describe it?
It's a little different to playing anywhere else. We have a singer-songwriters evening every fourth Thursday of the month, when we invite singer-songwriters to come in and share a little piece of spotlight. So there's a little bit of added pressure, especially if you're performing alone. And, you know, everybody's hanging on your every word or whatever you're playing. So it's a little different. But the other side of the coin there is it's very personal and comfortable. So it's a good opportunity for folks to try out maybe a new song or bring some new material in and just spend some time sharing what they create in front of a friendly audience.
What's the format like for this, the songwriter's showcase?
It's essentially like a night out listening to these beautiful creative pieces that people have put together. And for me as a singer-songwriter, it's a new realm. It's something different. You know, people are making songs out of real stories, songs that have a message. And that's where it is for me as a singer-songwriter. Listening to music, for me, has to contain an element of a message in there, something worthwhile of saying, plus the instrumentation that makes a great song. And that's what you get in the songwriter evening, the real deal.
One thing about the songwriter showcase that has really blown me away is how supportive the crowd is. You can hear a pin drop as soon as the song starts, and you feel the people in the crowd encouraging the artist. So I think the artist kind of rises to that level.
She walks on the beaches, picking up the very pieces of their lives, turning time. Don't know if she is a widow or a bride.
Beaches is a ghost story. So the story behind it is, several years ago, I was wild camping out on the coast of an island called Barra, which is in the Outer Hebrides of Scotland. So Western Isles, way out there. I'd arrived fairly late. My transportation was my bicycle, so I had everything on board and my bike, and I got the ferry over from the mainland and arrived in the darkness for my first night out, and essentially found the first beach I could find, somewhere I could hide away and stay for the night, you know. And fell asleep pretty easily, listening to the waves and amongst the dunes. And just snuggled in my sleeping bag there. And then in the middle of the night, in the early hours, I was suddenly awoken by children running around me, jumping over my sleeping bag, messing around. And I could hear their parents chastising them a little, saying, "Come away, leave him alone, poor guy, he's just trying to sleep." That sort of thing, just a whole commotion of a crowd of people. And I was in one of those deep, deep sleeps where I couldn't really raise my head off the ground for some reason for the longest time. And eventually it's like, you've got to get up and see what's going on here. And managed to force myself to sit up, and it was all quiet on the beach. There was nothing to be seen. So uneasily, I eventually got back to sleep. And in the morning, I pushed my bike off, out of the dunes, and walked past this memorial stone. And the memorial stone marked the grave site which I slept on top of. The grave site, memorial commemorated the steamership Annie Jane that sailed from Barra, heading for the States in 1853 was the year, and struck rocks and sank, and everybody on board perished in that seafaring tragedy. 384 people lost their lives and were buried in a communal site that I chose to sleep on top of that night.
Wow.
So I, on that journey, I composed a few songs, but one of them is based on that story, and I call it Beaches.
What's going on in the wine industry in North Carolina today? We hear a lot about it. We were one of the biggest wine producers in the country way, way back, weren't we?
Pre-Prohibition, North Carolina was the largest wine producer.
How about that?
And right now, I think there's over 130 wineries, but we've seen the industry mature as growers get more accustomed to growing grapes in North Carolina. They're producing better fruit. The vineyards are getting older, so you're getting more concentration in the flavors.
So from pre-Prohibition times, then we kind of fell off the map for a while. Now it seems like the industry in the Yadkin Valley area and others is really in a resurgence mode. How big of a resurgence has it been, and what do you see, you know, moving forward?
When Brushy Mountain Winery opened in 2006, there were 13 wineries in the Yadkin Valley. I think right now there are over 40.
Wow.
So really in this 10-year span, it's just grown exponentially. And what we're seeing, and what I think is more important, is the wines are getting much better. People just understand growing grapes here and making wines in North Carolina. And you're starting to really see them in a class of their own. North Carolina wines are distinct and very pleasurable. And across the state, people are making them for all kinds of different palates. We're in the land of sweet tea and Pepsi, so we all have to make a little bit of sweet wine, but a lot of people are generating or moving more towards drier wines, and that's helped propelling the industry as well.
It's easy to be a cheerleader. I know that, and you're in the industry, but given your perspective and having done internships and worked in Napa Valley, the holy grail of winemaking in this country, what needs to happen moving forward to make North Carolina not just competing for awards, but actually winning awards in terms of the quality of their wines?
Well, we do quite well in national, international competitions and regional competitions. So there are quite a few North Carolina wineries that have won the San Francisco Chronicle has a big competition, and several North Carolina wineries have won that. So
How about that? We're
getting recognition. What I think needs to happen is there needs to be more acceptance amongst the restaurateurs and wine shop owners to put North Carolina wines out there and give their consumers a chance to buy them. I think that's really the will turn the key to really open up North Carolina wines.
Well, Jason Wiseman and Julian Charles, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Brushy Mountain Winery owner Jason Wiseman and singer-songwriter Julian Charles of Bandit's Roost. We've been sampling from their new CD, Stone Circles. They've got music going on at Brushy Mountain every week. The winery's songwriter showcase is the fourth Thursday of the month, and this Sunday will be their very first house concert with Matt Bednarski. Brushy Mountain's Chardonnays and Pinot Gris have won silver and gold medals at the Mid-Atlantic and Indy International Wine Competitions. Its Booger Swamp white wine was featured on the Jay Leno Show and in the Washington Post. You'll find links to more at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. Wow, did you know that North Carolina was such a wine-making powerhouse? I've lived here for just over a decade, and it was news to me. Well, let's hope the local restaurant scene gives the industry the big bear hug it deserves and keeps the ball rolling. Well, here's some more news. Did you know that our state is home to some of the most talented pastel artists around? No, it's true, and I've got two of the finest next after this short break. I'm David Ford, and I hope you'll stick around to meet them. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford with your one-stop art shop here in the Piedmont Triad. Why, today, for example, we've gone from psychedelic pop to Pinot Gris, and we'll wrap up with Piedmont Winds. But next, it's time for Pastels with Patricia. And you see, that's just the arts beginning with the letter P. On Common Ground, 2015 Pastel Paintings from the Mountains to the Sea. It's the title of the fourth annual North Carolina statewide juried pastel exhibition beginning this week in Greensboro. Patricia Savage is an award-winning landscape, wildlife, and botanical artist and past president of the North Carolina Pastel Society. She's joined by Laura Pollock, an award-winning fine artist and graphic designer. What grabbed you painting landscapes?
Play of light and dark, of sunlight and shadow, the rhythms, just the beauty. And going outside and painting is glorious. A week ago, for instance, a group of artists in Greensboro said, we're going out to paint in one of the old neighborhoods, and we just sat up on a street, and we were painting, and we just loved it.
Well, I love your watercolor portrait, Feathers and Felt, too.
Oh,
I mean,
thank you.
You really, you're just shifting from watercolor to pastel and then from portraiture to landscapes. I mean, is that unusual, first off? And what are some of the challenges going from portraiture to a landscape?
I believe that the fundamentals are the same. How do you apply the paint? How do you get the rhythm, the light, and the dark? But there is a very large difference between portrait, trying to get the essence of a person. And with landscape, yes, you're trying to capture the essence of a moment in time so that someone can travel with you through that serene, hopefully serene time and enjoy that time and place and revisit it anytime they want to. With a portrait, you're trying to immortalize someone and capture their essence and, again, relay it to the viewer.
Is there a longer leash when you're doing a nature scene or a landscape in terms of recreating it in your own image versus an exact portraiture, or are they similar in that way or no?
I couldn't agree with you more. There's a much longer leash. In fact, I just finished yesterday a fourth version of the exact same landscape. I did the first one with the actual colors that were there that day, that time, in that morning. And this latest one, I have pushed the colors very hard to almost pure primaries. And it gives me a great deal of joy. It tickles me to just see how far I can take it.
What other things does it take to be a great wildlife pastel artist?
Drawing. A lot of drawing skill. Because if you can't draw, at least for wildlife, doing the kind of wildlife I do, you're not going to be able to recreate the animal because you've got to know basic anatomy. You've got to know how the animal is structured. You've got to know, you know, if this is a zoo animal, it's probably going to be out of shape, might be fat, overweight. It could have something wrong with it. You know, it may have atrophied muscles. So you have to understand your basic anatomy so that if you're trying to recreate an African mammal that's in its prime, you're going to have to make adjustments. If you're going to specialize in a certain species, you're going to need to draw it and draw it and draw it and draw it until you can almost draw it from memory so that you can, in your mind, rotate it if you need to be able to get different perspectives of the animal.
Could you, no pun intended, flesh this out for me a little further? Why is that so important to be able to go from A to Z to get the full package?
Well, it kind of depends on the direction you want your own work to go in. For when I'm building up a painting, I'll actually start with a composition first, because if I don't have that basic structure of my composition, my painting is not going to work. I'll do actually thumbnail sketches to start working out my basic shapes. And that's where I start working out, all right, what is the point of this painting? You know, what am I trying to say? I'm going to have a focal point. Where is that going to be? What is it going to be? Do I want it an in-your-face focal point? Do I want it to be a very subtle focal point that it takes a little while to find? Do I want to have one primary focal point or several little focal points with one primary? And from that, I start figuring out the positions of my animals. I will do research and sketches of my animals or plants, depending on what it is that I'm concentrating on, so that I get a feel for what that is, the direction I want it to be in. And those are just general shapes. And that's kind of where they're starting in a lot of these books, is just, you know, little circles for the head and ovals for the bodies and ovals for the legs. I start off with that. And then as I start getting into my real drawing, when I've got my composition, that's when I start fleshing out my animal. And, you know, I can go to zoos, I can go to the internet. Hopefully I will have been able to spend some time with that animal and done some field sketches and things like that. So I'll have stuff that I can pull from so that I can get a fairly accurately drawn animal. And if I'm, you know, if it's going to be entered into a wildlife show, generally those are going to be fairly realistic drawings, so I don't quite push my color like I do my plants. For my plant paintings, I push color.
And when you say push color, you mean take some chances?
I'm starting, rather than trying to do exactly what I'm seeing, I'm starting to feel for my color.
What's the difference?
One, I'll orient my paints to be what I'm seeing in front of me. You know, I'm going to try and have a harmonious palette, because I want all my colors to be relating and speaking to each other. For the other, what I'm trying to achieve, especially with my botanicals, is I'm not going to concentrate too much on the realism of what I'm actually seeing in front of me. Sometimes I'll put my subject to the side so that I can't see it. And then I start, not playing, exploring my paints to see what kind of color mixtures that I can come up with that make me excited, that make my heart just go, that just kind of leaps inside me.
Well, Patricia, your paintings cover the gamut from really highly detailed flowers I'm seeing and animals to almost impressionistic landscapes. Your meadow, that house out there is so beautiful. Is that ability to shift gears unusual? And what are some of the different associations, I guess, you have with each as you shift from almost not hyper-realism, but something in that category to, like I say, impressionistic?
All of them have their own kind of resonance. I mean, there's times where either just because of the job and the deadline or, you know, the requirements for the job, I have to head in a certain direction. I don't have any choice. So it's got to stay realistic, or it can be a little bit more interpretive on how I'm approaching the job. And for the paintings themselves, it's when I'm studying my subject, somewhere along the line, I'll decide this one I want to be a little bit more realistic. This one just feels like I just want to play with color versus what is actually out there.
Does the painting decide for you?
Kind of in a way it does. I mean, that house that's out in the field, that house looks nothing like. I changed that house quite a bit. That house happened to be on the property of Shoals Marine Lab, which is up in it's their land side versus the island side. And it was just this house, and I fell in love with the house. But it's inside of this, the lawn was extremely mowed, and it had just, you know, the house was falling apart. It hadn't been used for a while. It had just this ugly, horrid landscaping. And then I was in Maine, and I saw this gorgeous field that was just carpeted in white Queen Anne's lace, which is basically what that was. So at some point in my head, as I was looking through my photographs, those two images came together. So I started doing a ton of thumbnail sketches to see how I can work these two together to make something that, you know, where my light was going to be coming from the same direction,
that always helps.
It looked like the same place. You know, so I was placing this house in a totally different landscape. So I had to make all that work, which is where the drawing comes in, because if you have enough drawing experience, you're able to integrate different subjects together, and which requires a lot of drawing skills.
I want to find out more about pastel art, beginning with soft pan and hard pastels. Laura, I'll throw it your way. How are they the same, and how are they different?
They're both pure pigment with the minimal amount of binder to hold them together. So if, for instance, you took a piece of pastel and you ground it up and put in certain oils, it would become an oil paint. Or if you put a different, I guess it would be gum arabic, it would become a watercolor.
Mm.
So this is the purest form of paint that is out there. It's also one of the most lasting and archival. With pan pastels, it's the same thing. It almost looks like a makeup rouge pan. Mm. You simply use a different method of application. You can either use a sponge, you could use your finger, you can use a brush to place it onto the substrate. And most substrates in pastel are a sanded paper that are created with archival properties so that they'll withstand the test of time and outlast our lives.
And the sanded paper to grab the color?
Yes, it holds the color on it. Some people use certain kinds of paper that don't have a grit to it, but it has a little bit of a texture. And back to the sanded paper, they're with all types of grits. If you went into a hardware store and you asked for sandpaper, they'll ask you, what grit would you like? Well, the same thing happens with pastels.
Mm.
The coarser grit will hold more, and the finer grits, perhaps used for portraiture, will blend smoother.
Over the last 10, 20 years, have you all noticed people gravitating more toward this art?
Yes, but we've worked at it too.
Mm. What was the bridge you needed to construct to make that more accessible?
I think having all these different pastel societies helps, because we have a community of artists that people can learn from to learn how to do pastels. And, you know, we're with these statewide shows, that gives people an opportunity to see pastel, and they get really excited because the application of color is very, very different from the other mediums. It's easy. You can set it down. You don't have to clean brushes. There's no fumes. You know, you can leave it for months and you go right back to it. So it's a very approachable technique.
There's a lot to love about pastel painting.
Yes.
I mean, I was looking online at just both of your old studios and just was blown away by the variety of paintings I'm seeing there. But at the Pastel Society of North Carolina exhibit, On Common Ground, 2015 Pastel Paintings from the Mountains to the Sea exhibit, I should say. Talk about just some of the variety of pastels and who will be, who's showing here?
Well, we have 258 artists.
Well, let's list them alphabetically.
Yeah, right.
If you hold on a second, I did the catalog on it.
She did the catalog.
258. That's amazing.
And actually from all around the country, mostly from the Southeast area. It's growing in its popularity, our show in particular, and it's becoming more and more prestigious each year. We have people from Florida to Tennessee, Georgia, and all across North Carolina, of course, entering the show. And the quality of work every year is stepping it up higher and higher. Everything from portraiture to landscape to still life. Exquisite works.
This is we should put on a juried show.
It is a juried show.
And the work, thankfully for us, is going to be available for purchase as well.
All for sale.
All for sale. That just sounds overwhelming. But the space, thankfully, is nice. I want to talk about the venue as well because it's... I'm just looking online. It looks like the perfect vehicle in terms of light and the setup there. Put me in the seat there at the Art Shop. What's it like?
Well, there are several beautiful galleries in Greensboro, but this has an open, beautifully lit space with lots of parking, and the lighting will highlight each piece beautifully. The Art Shop has been the oldest gallery in Greensboro. In fact, on their website, they state that they're the second oldest business in Greensboro. They've been in business since the 1800s. So it is a lovely space. We're very fortunate to have them. They're right off of Market Street with plenty of parking.
That's quite a track record. I had the good fortune of being able to see a couple of images that will be on display. One, a sand dune by Deb Raspberry, titled Looking Back, and just stunningly vivid colors from the blue of the sea to the colorful greens and browns on the sand and then the grasses growing up on it. How does the medium lend itself so well to nature scenes like this one? I mean, I really feel like I could just step off into that.
What's wonderful about pastel and using that sanded paper is that you can layer and you can veil color, and the crystals of the pastel, if you don't push them too far into the paper, will each shimmer in each layer. And if you layer lightly, then you get all these different layers that are combining in your eye to create new and fresh colors, almost like Seurat, the Impressionist painter. So it blends in your eye, and you get a fresher look than in almost any other medium.
That would explain why the water in that popped so well for me. And then the other image that blew me away was the fishing boat, Beaufort's Alice Marie by Diana Croydon.
Yes.
The water and reflection was something I've never seen. I mean, I've seen it in watercolor occasionally by real masters, but now here, and also the detailed ship rigging and the realistic depiction of the ship and the perspective. Well, tell me about the artist. Who's Diana Croydon?
She actually has a house. She lives in the Raleigh area, but she has a house down in Beaufort. She has been painting boats forever and scenes from the coast. And she has this amazing ability of being able to do this fine, fine detail and then just doing beautiful overlays and overglazes with the pastels on top of each other and that are just exquisite.
Overlays and overglaze. That's kind of, I guess, finally giving me an inkling as to how you recreate water with pastel in such beautiful ways. The third work that I looked at was called Pure Joy is a Purple Ball. Did you see that?
An exquisite piece.
It was a dog in the water with a ball, I think a yellow lab by Alec Hall. And it just takes water to a whole new level of realism. I was looking, zooming in on my computer screen, and I thought I must have counted a dozen different colors in just the water itself, which maybe gives me an inkling as to how you recreate that.
But. You're absolutely right. What you're visualizing, what you're seeing is the artist layering and using that manipulation of color to create that image and the illusion, because, of course, these are illusions on a two-dimensional surface of a three-dimensional object. And the movement of the water actually comes through. That was a beautiful piece.
Yeah, stunning. Pastel artists Lori Pollock and Patricia Savage. The exhibition On Common Ground, 2015 Pastel Paintings from the Mountains to the Sea, begins Saturday night, May 16th at 6 p.m. in the Art Shop in West Market in Greensboro, where it'll remain through June 16th. Saturday night's opening reception will feature exhibit juror and renowned artist Teresa Saya, who will be giving a demonstration and lecture on Saturday as well. It's open to the public with RSVP at the Art Shop. Paintings will be for sale, and you'll find information as well as images from the show at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. But before you rush off to RSVP, you're going to want to stick around for this. The Piedmont Wind Symphony wraps up its exciting 25th season with a Downton Abbey evening featuring the outstanding British music of the era. It's being conducted by their new music director, Matthew Troy, who follows the Downton Abbey theme song with music by English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams.
There's a lot of different musical lines that are interacting all the time. It's kind of thickly scored, and it just has a great kind of martial, kind of march-like feel to it. And it does have the typical Vaughan Williams, like much of the music that we will do. It's rooted in English folk song. And so while it may sound complicated, a lot of this music is really rooted in things that are very tuneful and very memorable, and actually a lot of tunes that are very familiar to the audience as well.
That's right. He, like Bela Bartok and Kodály, would actually go off in the countryside and record some of these songs.
That's right. He was kind of very involved in the birth of musicology and going out and kind of recording these folk songs, and then they were just a really important part of his music overall. He collected a massive amount of folk tunes, and you can really, I think, feel that influence in all of his music.
You've got Walton on the program.
That's right. Walton, another very famous English composer who wrote in really all kinds of different genres, and he even wrote several film scores as well during the time. But he was also inspired by the birth of this English brass band, English military band music, and was excited by that sound and wrote this great march, the Crown Imperial March, which fits into Downton Abbey kind of theme of royalty and aristocracy of the day, and it just has a really regal feeling throughout the piece.
You follow that with Percy Grainger. There's something so individual about his style. I can't quite put my finger on it, but you know it's Grainger when you hear it.
That's right. He does have a very distinctive characteristic. I think a lot of it actually is, you know, related to his love of the clarinet and the saxophone. And so those instruments certainly get the feature in this next piece that we're playing. It's called Molly on the Shore, and it's just one of the staples of the wind ensemble repertoire. I think maybe with Percy Grainger, he sounds so unique because he actually was an Australian composer, Australian born, but of English extraction. And so I think he has kind of a slightly different sound. And then he was also studying with other very inventive composers like Delius, and was friends with Delius and Grieg, very close to the Grieg family. And so this piece is kind of based on two Irish reels. So you're going to hear kind of this very, you know, folksy element in Grainger's music, Molly on the Shore. And he features the clarinet and saxophone very prominently.
You can't have a program with Vaughan Williams without including music by his good buddy and former, I guess they were classmates or overlapped at in college, Gustav Holst.
That's right. I mean, Gustav Holst may be one of the most famous of all British composers. I think he's most well known for his work, The Planets, but obviously wrote lots of other great works. He also, like Vaughan Williams, had a tremendous love of English folk song and was born in a time period when he was very much inspired and influenced by the romanticism of Wagner and Strauss. And so I think you can hear that in pretty much all of Gustav Holst's music.
Piedmont Wind Symphony music director Matthew Troy. The Downton Abbey evening at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art is Thursday, May 21st. An entire evening built around all things Downton, beginning with a pre-concert party featuring Downton Abbey-inspired drinks and hors d'oeuvres. After the concert, which includes the theme song from Downton Abbey, guests will be treated to live jazz by the Matt Kendrick Trio, dessert, and dancing. Period attire is encouraged, and you'll find links at WFDD.org. Just click on Triad Arts Weekend. Well, that's all for today's program. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia. Our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. And you'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of our guests and events and more on our website, WFDD.org. Just be sure and click on Triad Arts Weekend. And as always, if you have questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email. That address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.